He took me back next door in that little room again and sat down. He banged his book on the table and said, look, it's time to come clean. It's time to tell the truth. I know you did it. Why don't you just started going off on me. That was it. I was ready to fight. I told him what I thought of him, what I thought of the police department. Why you wasting my time? I didn't kill her. I told you I didn't kill her. And by the way, your 3 hours are up.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
My name's Ed, and for the past 2 decades, I've been producing true crime content for some of your favorite networks like Hulu, Oxygen, and of course, Investigation Discovery.
And I'm Melissa, Ed's bestie and walking, talking true crime database.
We've combined my behind-the-scenes insight with Melissa's morbid curiosity to bring you a podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before.
We highlight victims' cases and bring you exclusive insight from the people who live through them, with a touch of humor to lighten even the darkest stories.
This is Murder Unscripted.
Dun dun dun.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome to episode 88 of Murder Unscripted, the internet's most immersive true crime podcast, or so we think.
So you think.
So I think. And my mom, she thinks so too. I am your host, Ed Hydock, along with my bestie, Melissa Spivey.
Hey, yo.
Well, Melissa, we are in the fourth and final week of our January 2026 block, which has been about exonerations. And we've been calling this Fresh Starts. And I think you're going to see why after our guest today.
Yeah, this has been a rough month. These cases have been rough. It's been a lot. It's been a sad month.
It has. And I think a lot of that stems from the fact that, and we'll talk to our guest about this when he comes on, but the fact that when you go to look for these exoneration cases, I feel like the victim sometimes gets lost in all of this. Like, obviously, mm-hmm. you have one victim who was wrongfully accused, but then you have a second victim who was murdered and maybe takes a backseat to the bigger story. Well, last week, that story we're talking about, we covered the 1991 murder of Kim Ancona at the CBS Lounge in Phoenix. And it's a case that resulted in one of the most disturbing wrongful convictions in American history. A man was sentenced to death, not just prison, death, because of his crooked teeth. Supposedly, these matched these bite marks on the victim's body. And the press had labeled him the Snaggletooth Killer. He spent over a decade behind bars, which meant years of his life were stolen, until DNA evidence proved what he'd been saying all along. That he was innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And that case, ironically, was the very first case that I had ever covered in my true crime career. It was
That's wild.
It's wild. It's the first phone call I ever made. And I was so nervous when I picked up the phone because I was just handed the reins to this story and haven't spoken to him since until today, minus a couple emails. But ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Murder Unscripted, Ray Crone.
Yay. Hi, Ray.
Hi, y'all.
What's up, Ray?
I'm doing okay here in East Tennessee.
Attaboy. When did you move out there?
Actually, it was about 12 years, 2012 it was. So almost 13 years now I moved down here from Pennsylvania after vacating Arizona.
Yeah, I hear that. Mm-hmm. What made you move?
You know, Pennsylvania, where I grew up, was my hometown. I went into service when I was young and lived a lot of different places, never really lived back there. I, as soon as I was released in Arizona, I moved back. Family, friends, people from school all settled. My whole family's there. And, you know, so it was a place to start over again. I had support, a mm-hmm. Place to live. You know, people offered me work. But after years, you know, I was in the news all the time. I don't want to say I was a celebrity, but people don't know what to say to you, you know. Welcome back. Sorry for what happened. You know, it's a terrible thing. Those kind of things. Everywhere I went, I was scrutinized by the media, by, you know, people wished me well. I didn't have no peace and quiet. And lastly, probably most importantly, is it wasn't the country living that it used to be. The traffic, the congestion, the expense of even living there. And I did Tennessee here in the Smoky Mountains. The people were great. The prices were fair. And I was able to find a wonderful piece of property right here on the lake that was you know, secluded and separated, but yet good neighbors that were, you know, down here you had to have at least 5 acres to live in this lot. So, you know your neighbors aren't right out your window or out your door.
Right.
So I really loved the people, the tranquility, that nobody knew me, nobody knew my story. I come down here, started a whole lot. I'm Ray Crone, a guy that moved from Pennsylvania, not Ray Crone, death row survivor.
course. And then here I come, be like, let's drag this back out in the spotlight again.
Well, it is part of my therapy. Honestly, I've been doing it since I got out. I had the good fortune to meet up with Sister Helen Prejean, become part of a group called Witness to Innocence. So I helped found that with her. It was her idea. We've spoke all over the United States on death penalty abolition cases, talking to governments. I spoke at both United Nations in New York and Geneva. I've been down to DC testifying. It's what I've done since, if I had to go through those 10 years, 3 months, and 8 days of prison, three of those on death row, it must have been a reason the Lord put me there. I had no record, no criminal record at all. I was 6 years active duty Air Force, honorable discharge, 7 years with the post office as a letter carrier. There's no reason to send me to death row. I used to believe in the death penalty. I found out that they lied about it. It's not the worst of the worst. It's being at the worst places of the worst. So only certain prosecutors seek it. Only big cities that can afford it. The representation, you can't hardly afford a good attorney. Just a lot of things that I realized that I need to share my story with people. I was asked to share my story. I was able to share my story. And as I say, that's part of my therapy, saying there must have been a reason. Maybe the Lord put me there for this reason, to say that, you know, if they can do it to me, no offense, but they can do it to anybody.
It's true. Like, you're a normal dude, just a normal guy. You're from Pennsylvania. We're like, just like we are. Like,
Ray, when you probably don't remember me, I was just setting stories up. Like, I wasn't actually producing at that point. So I was so nervous to call you. And when I did, and you were so just polite, and that was because that was going back to 2003. So, I mean, we weren't that terribly far removed from the whole situation. What did it feel like to kind of be contacted again? Like, have you ever done a podcast before?
I would say yes. Again, the new technology, what they call podcasts and interviews and stuff. Even during COVID, I speak to a lot of universities, colleges, law schools, church groups. There's just a lot of variety of different people that are interested in it. So I've had to do, online stuff before, Skypes and whatever the different things that there are. But as far as podcasts, I've sat in radio stations, done radio shows. So I guess there's something similar I did somewhere over all these years.
Yeah, that counts. Well, not all of our listeners so listen to every single episode. Like, some may just tune in to hear your interview rather than listening to our coverage of the case. So kind of take us back to 1991. And I want you to tell our listeners who Ray Krohn was back then, before all this happened.
I think, if you don't mind, I'll take it back even a little bit further. I'll go back to actually where I'm born and raised, from a little town, Dover, Pennsylvania, in York County, a small agricultural town. I mean, I was one of those small towns like you hear all the time, where everybody knew everybody. I went to the same high school my parents went to, the same church my great-grandparents went to.
Wow.
I was in Little League baseball, peewee football. I was in a church choir. Lutherans are all around here. We're German. Mm-hmm. And, I was reasonably athletic, but not college bound athletic. I did good in school. I graduated in the top 15% of my high school, but I ended up listed in the U.S. Air Force at the age of 17. And when I graduated in 1974, I started my Air Force career. 6 years, I was an electronic computer system repairman, worked on radar sites that they had, used to have all along the coast.
Wow.
I went from Texas to Mississippi to Georgia to Maine, and then to Phoenix, Arizona. My 6 years were up, and I stayed out there. It was 1980. I liked it out there. It was sun and fun as a 23, 24-year-old man. Plenty of work, plenty of things to do. I ended up, after a few years, got a job with the U.S. Postal Office. A great job, great career. I liked it. I was outside delivering mail, meeting people in that sunny weather. Bought my own home, and life was good. I was still involved with sports. I played volleyball. I was in the dart league. I played pool. I played on a softball league. And that's really where my problems arose, because the bar where this murder had happened was a bar that I recently started going to, played the volleyball on a pickup volleyball team every weekend, and also shot darts with the bartender, Kim, God bless you, Kim and Kona, who was brutally murdered. I actually had shot darts when I'd stop. And it was halfway between my house and where I worked at the post office, which was only actually about a mile and a half from my house. So it was convenient. And that's how I got involved in this.
Interesting. One thing I wanted to get to the bottom of, because there are definitely mixed reports, and I went back and I watched the old Forensic Files episode just to refresh. I mean, obviously, but like Hank Arredondo, the owner of that bar, he was like, yeah, Ray Krohn, not a real well-liked guy. People didn't really care for him. And what's your take on this?
Well, of course, it's my side of the story, but I'm not one to lie or exaggerate, to be perfectly honest with you. I'd tell you that real simply. He only owned that bar for about 2 months, so he didn't know me to begin with. I'd only started going to that bar because another bar that I used to play volleyball on Sundays, we'd have a pickup game. A group of people get together. We'd get our couple cases of beer from the bar. We'd go play volleyball at the local park there, a city park, come back to the bar, and then we'd eat and drink the evening away and socialize. And it was a good deal for the bar. And anyway, that bar closed up, and a friend at this new bar, CBS Lounge, said, well, they'll do it there. And so we started going there. I'd only been going to the bar a couple months myself. But I worked for the post office. I had a Corvette, I had a motorcycle, I had a boat, I had a lot of things. And this was a working man's bar. And no offense to people here, me and my friends come in. I was in the top league division, a dart shooter. I was a pretty good volleyball player, reasonably athletic. And so it just rubbed some people the wrong way. Mm. It wasn't why I was there to make friends with people. I was there because it was convenient again. I did have a dart board where I could shoot. And I didn't really know anybody when I started going there except the people I played volleyball with on Sundays. And to give an example of what kind of man this was, the owner, after I was convicted of his death, his family filed a wrongful death suit trying to get to workman's comp. He denied it, said she allowed a person in there against the rules, and denied his family all that money that would have been coming to her family. I just thought it was outrageous that he would make a claim like that, not try to help that family after their circumstances.
Absolutely. Well, and what I was kind of mentioning in my intro was that when we've done three exoneration cases this month, and in each case we could find so little about the victim, the one who was murdered, and it's sad. So can you tell us about Kim?
Yeah, Kim had worked there for a few years. She was a regular bartender there, just dependable, reliable. Lived real nearby. She was living with a fellow, had a couple teenage kids, I believe a boy and a girl, I believe. Recently, the manager who had been manager had a argument or a trouble with the manager, or excuse me, with the owner, and ended up being fired. And he had asked Kim to take over it was just a few days before her death. And she was now the night manager. Again, she deserved it. She was friendly. Everybody liked her. She actually had a dart team of her own. There was different divisions, 1 through 8. And she was her team was down in the lower division. But when I'd stop in, she'd come over and want to shoot darts with her friends when she'd get off work. That was before she worked a night shift, but she was just a very dependable, likable person. Everybody liked her that I could tell. And again, I'd only been going there a few months. And again, I wasn't the social butterfly to everybody in there and knew everybody. It was just a few people that I knew and a couple people that came in with me, my friends.
I was trying to figure out what your actual relationship with Kim was like, because some were saying that you were, I guess, trying to date her, or you weren't, or you were just friends. And like, there was some back and forth.
Well, what do the police need for their motive? What do the prosecutor need to get a conviction? It has to have a tie-in. There has to be a reason.
Right.
None of it was true. I knew her from the bar. She lived with a man. She lived with a man. She had two teenage children. Not that mattered to me, that part of it, but it wasn't something I was interested in. I wasn't looking for a girlfriend. She was nice. She's like, well, if any of you all know, you're going to a bar, you want to know the bartenders, you'd like to know the owner, you'd like to be social with them. It helps with the way they treat you. With your service and everything else. So it really was just a typical thing with me. I played again in a lot of bars, from darts, from pool. It was just one of those things that, I always was nice to the bartenders, managers. I was fortunate enough to be able to tip well enough, not to be buying anything, not to be trying to solicit anything, but I was just like that. And again, that rubs some people the wrong way. It was just, I wasn't an in-your-face kind of guy, but maybe in a way that was even worse to them because I wasn't like that. So some of the people did talk. I did have a problem with one of the bartenders that would always kind of give me a hard time when I want to come in. And she's the one that told the police that Kim told her that I was coming in to close up, which is what they first got onto me, because they originally, after they found her body, talked to their coworkers, and one of them said that Ray Crone was coming in to close up, that Kim liked him. And that's where this all started. They build the story from there because, again, that helps build that motive. That helps give them a case.
Which is so messed up.
That was actually my next question. What was happening that night? Because investigators claimed you and Kim had plans, whereas you've always said that wasn't true. And I believe your roommate backed you up. So I wondered where that story came from.
But what had actually happened that day, if you remember now, this was over the Christmas holiday breaks. This was a couple of days before, actually December 29th. It was a Saturday night. I had to work that Saturday at the post office. Friday night, the night before, was a Christmas party. I was young. I was 34 years old. I was up late, had to go to work at the post office, delivered my mail, got off work, went home. We're watching football games. I got picked up a pizza there at that actual next door. I picked up a pizza. There's a pizza place in this little strip mall where the bar was. I picked up a pizza, waited for that pizza, had a beer, got the pizza, went home, and we ate pizza with my friends. A couple of my friends were crashed out on the floor when I went to work in the morning. And when I got home that Saturday afternoon with the pizza, we stayed there. We watched football. I went to bed about 9 o'clock. I was so tired from the night before as festivities. I never got up till the next morning. My roommate, Steve, was there. He knows I never left. He was home there. He swore to the cops I never left. After my arrest, they sent a person they called a alibi buster over, a policeman who kept badgering him. Well, how do you know he didn't leave? Well, his car is right out. Well, did you see him all night long? No, I know. You didn't sleep in the same room. All that kind of stuff kept going on. So you don't really know that he was in his room. Well, I guess not, but I'm sure he was, kind of thing. And then they go back and say, well, Steve couldn't verify his that he was there. That kind of stuff that they pull, which, again, to me, as never having to deal with the justice system, I could not believe that people act like that, especially somebody that's supposed to be about justice, about the truth, about protecting their citizens. Again, to keep this in mind, folks, I was arrested 2 days after the murder. Mm-hmm. You know, so it wasn't, they didn't have a case. They built a case afterwards. They had to have things fit when stuff didn't line up.
That had to be quite a shock to learn that this bar you were just partying at, having a great time, talking with Kim and stuff, and then you, when do you hear the news?
It was 1 o'clock that Sunday. My dog was outside, a big Doberman. He doesn't bark much. When he does, I paid attention. I got up and looked out the window, and there was a car that just pulled up in front of my neighbor's house. Now, we're in a development in the city there. The houses are pretty close together, had a common driveway, parking area there. A car had pulled up in front of my neighbor's house, looking out the window. 2 men in suits got out. By the time I got outside and let my door in from the carport, now my carport was blocked off with the gate there, so the dog couldn't get out to the street. But they were walking up my driveway, and I stepped out. I said, excuse me, can I help you? And one man said, yes, are you Ray Crone? I said, yes, Sam, what can I do for you? And right away he said, you know Kim and Kona? I thought, no, I don't think I know anybody named Kim and Kona. He looked at the guy next to him, back at me. He said, you don't know Kim and Kona from the CBS Lounge? I said, well, wait a minute. I go to a bar, you know, CBS Lounge. I shoot darts there. I said, there's a girl there named Kim that works there.
Why would you know her last name?
I didn't know her last name. I said, I don't know her last name. He looks at me and said, you don't know her last name? You're a boyfriend, aren't you? I said, no, I'm not a boyfriend. What are you talking about? He said, well, you're dating her, aren't you? I said, no, I'm not dating her. What is this about?
That story came together so quickly against you.
At that point, he opened up his jacket and actually pulled out a badge and identified himself as a homicide detective and informed me right then that Kim had been murdered and was there to ask me a few questions. I said, sure, come on inside. He said, no, we really need to do this downtown, if you don't mind. And they loaded me in a black and white police car and took me down to the police station for the next 3 hours, grilled me.
First of all, you don't get a chance to even absorb the news that somebody, like, I think for me, that would be a big deal. If I was at a bar the night before and did have a friendly relationship with a bartender that I knew, and I found out she was murdered, that would be a big shock. But you don't even have time to, like, absorb that, because now you're being dragged down to the station.
Absolutely. And it was, and again, and it took a while for that shock to be, because now the shock is the way they were questioning me about this boyfriend. It's like, where do you get something like that from? No, you know, and I went at the police station. I mean, they took my mug shots. They took fingerprints of me. They had me take my shirt off, took pictures of my torso, looking for any type of wounds. There were none. Mm-hmm. They took my sneakers at one point. Another point, they had a piece of styrofoam, kind of like off an insulated coffee cup, taped together, had me bite into that. I didn't know what was going on. They didn't feed me any information. I just answered the questions. You know, how long you been dating? How many times she been over to your house? You been over to her? All of us, no, I'm dating her. She's never been to my house. I would see her at the bar. That was it. You know, it went on for 3 hours, and then he finally took me home.
Wow.
When you're sitting there biting into a styrofoam cup, are you just like, what the hell is going on here?
Again, I'm not an 18, 19-year-old kid here. I'm 34, almost about to be 35. My birthday's in January. You know, so I was about to be 35 years old. Yeah, this is not something I'm used to, even as an older adult. You know, that I don't watch this stuff on television. I was completely stunned and flabbergasted. Like, well, let's just get this over with, because, you know, you need to go find who did this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But afterwards, then I left here. I'm stunned. Why the stuff that they had already in 2 or 3 hours already believed a boyfriend and I was dating her and stuff like that. Where would you come? Who would say something?
Yeah, like, who's spinning this story? People.
Right. You talk to people that know me, not people that don't like me.
Oh my God. You probably had no idea that little styrofoam cup would change your life.
Yeah, I found out, because actually then the next day more things came together. Because the next day, it was a Monday now, I delivered my mail. I come home and there was Detective Gregory come right at the door there, said, I'm not sure you've been completely truthful. You want to cooperate, don't you, Mr. Crone? I said, well, sure. What do you need me to cooperate with? And, you know, kind of stumbled around with my words, looking at him there at the front door. And he said, well, I want to eliminate you as a suspect. I need you to come downtown and with me and answer a few more questions. I agreed. Again, I volunteered, no question asked. This time I got in his detective car, owned Mark Carr, and rode down there to that same old interrogation room. Only this time when I stepped in, as soon as I stepped inside that door, he said, oh, yeah, by the way, I got a search warrant here. And you're going to give me a hair sample, a blood sample, to cast your teeth. Now I freaked out a little bit. Now I got a little angry. I felt a little aggressive. This is a little, you know, frightening here. And he just, you know, he let me see it. They let me read it. I read it. It was signed by a judge, said they had 3 hours to do all this. And so I cooperated. I cooperated and he took blood out of both arms. I'm not sure he didn't realize it's going to be the same.
It's the same circuit, yeah.
I cooperated and he took hair. They do not take hair with scissors. No. They pull it out by the roots from different parts of your body.
Mm-hmm.
I cooperated through that.
Because you were innocent.
Then they took me next door. Had a bigger room set up with a dentist chair in there and another man in there sat me down in this dentist chair, had me laid back, had this apparatus in my mouth, spread my teeth apart and gripped me and put this metal cast of with goop in, took two casts of my upper and two casts of my lower and spread my lips around, taking pictures and asking me questions about my history, my dentition. And back when I was 18 years old in the Air Force, I was in a head-on collision, passenger head-on collision. Woke up in the hospital with my mouth wired shut, a broken jaw.
Wow.
6 weeks went by. The wires came off, the bottom jaw and the top jaw didn't line up anymore. They had to go in, take part of the bone out of my bottom jaw, wire my mouth shut again for another 6 weeks. So I went 12 weeks without really any real dental assistance there. So I had some teeth that had died. I had to get some root canals, some bridge work done, permanent bridge work done. So I was always careful with my teeth since I was 18 years old. I mean, I wasn't eating corn on the cob. I wasn't eating fresh apples. And here they were poking around in my mouth for about 2.5 hours.
Wow.
Finally, when that was over, I was wore out, and he took me back next door in that little room again and sat down. He banged his book on the table and said, look, it's time to come clean. It's time to tell the truth. I know you did it. Why don't you just start going off on me? That was it. I was ready to fight. I told him what I thought of him, what I thought of the police department, why you wasted my time. I didn't kill her. I told you I didn't kill her. And by the way, your 3 hours are up. He looked at me, he looked down at his watch. He said, look, Mr. Crone, I'm not going to argue with you. There's other ways to handle this. Loaded up his stuff, took me out in his car, drove me home the 15-minute drive, and that's never said a word to him. I thought that was it. Well, I found out what he meant by other ways to handle this the next day, December 31st, 1991, New Year's Eve, 4 o'clock. I'm pulling into my driveway, just stepping out of my car. All of a sudden, I hear the screech of tires, a bullhorn yelling, freeze, don't move. It's a van loaded full of police officers, full riot gear, guns drawn, bailed on me, threw me down, handcuffed me, and arrested me for murder, kidnapping, and sexual assault. New Year's Eve, 4 o'clock, took me to the Maricopa County Jail. Joe Arpaio's famous gulag took me to Joe Arpaio's place on New Year's Eve. Never been to jail, never been to prison, didn't even watch that stuff on TV. And I was around a whole lot of people I knew I was not going to like.
Do you hate New Year's Eve now?
Hate's a strong word. If I can't even feel hate for the prosecutor and the detective, it brings back memories, everyone, believe me. Sure. And I know it's 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time when I was arrested out in Arizona. It does bring back memories, but yeah, that was my New Year's need of 1992 going in, or 91 going into 92.
Wow. So when they claim that your teeth were a 100% match, what was your immediate reaction? Like, how did it feel hearing that?
Well, it's impossible. You're full of you-know-what. And, you know, I'm in the county jail at the time when I finally got a court-appointed attorney to represent me. But I was biting into sandwiches and looking at this thing. I was biting into my skin to see what kind of marks it was. You know, I just stuff is like, this is ridiculous. They'll straighten this out anyhow because there's no way. I wasn't there at that time. There has to be some evidence. I was home in bed. Nobody ever seen me leave. I got a Corvette. I had a truck. I mean, you would have heard or seen me leave. And, you know, this would be all right. I'd be going home any minute. And then it turned into days. And then it turned into weeks and then months. And then just 7 months after my arrest, I'm in trial.
Man. Wow.
Well, the thing that has always struck me about this case from day one, of all the teeth, of all the people that could have done this in the world, it happened to be somebody who had a similar mouth to what you had at the time.
Jeez.
Yes, it's all, it really was. And again, when you hear a bite mark, what are you going to think of? Like when you bite into a sandwich and you got a nice perfect curve and you know,
yeah,
and
all, the little
32 teeth. No, There was actually, I think, no more than about six teeth or so that this dentist identified as matching mine. But I had a unique tooth because of the result of that accident that I said I was in. One of my front tooth, the very middle front tooth, had started dropping down lower than the other bridge work around it. So it was actually a little bit longer than the rest of the teeth. And that's the one that they used to identify me originally, this local medical examiner. And by the way, that man that was in the dentist chair when I said I was being questioned, he was a local medical examiner. He was a dentist by trade. He was also being trained to be a forensic odontologist, but he was not board certified, so he could not testify. But he's the one who got the arrest warrant identified and said it was my teeth.
Unreal. What did your family and friends think? Were they behind you the whole time, 100%? Or was there doubt in their mind, like, they just arrested him, they got these teeth that kind of look the same, maybe he did do it?
Again, I was 35 years old. My family knew me. My friends knew me. I've been around a lot of people for a lot of years. And so I was very, very fortunate because that's it. I only had to tell my family once I didn't do this. They believe me. Now, they're 2,500 miles away in Pennsylvania. I was able to make a phone call to my sister. I believe she passed it on. Eventually, my folks were able to come visit me. But my local friends that knew me were no way. They knew I didn't do it. My friend Steve knew I was home in bed. So I was very fortunate I had the support there. And again, having played sports, you know, if I got a team around me, I don't want to let them down. So it's like, I'll be okay. Everything's all right. People come see me. No, I'm all right. And then even after getting convicted, it's like, no, I'll be okay. And I get sentenced to death. I'll be okay. But the folks kept fighting for me. But I'll tell you a little story that'll give you an example. Yeah. I'm on death row. I get a letter. Again, I'm in the papers back in Pennsylvania now. I get a letter from my seventh grade English teacher. He sends there, he said, I don't believe any of this. He said, I remember from your school, you were more of a cut up. You know, he said, you're more of a kind of, not quite a class clown. He said, but you were trying to be. He said, you're very sharp, intelligent. He said, you'd always had to be the first one done turning your questions, and you'd always get one or two wrong. He said, because you'd hurry. He said, I don't believe any of this at all, you know. And I wrote him a letter back thanking him and, you know, a little bit about the story. I got the letter back in about a week or two with red correction marks on my letter.
That's awesome.
But that was from like 1969 to 68, somewhere in there when I was in seventh grade. Wow. That he wrote me and did not believe it.
It didn't take long for people to, the big headline, Snaggletooth Killer. Like, that had to be something that kind of hurt you emotionally and your family and your friends as well to hear something like this.
It was fortunate in a way, if there's any things that turned out to be better than worse, was that it was not my family's hometown, that my family and friends weren't, I have some friends there. I lived in Phoenix by that time, about 11, 12 years, I believe, almost then. So it was fortunate, at least my family wasn't around people that were the ones, the haters, the believers that thought I could do that, that my family was a subject of that. And back in Pennsylvania, back in my small town, everybody supported me. Again, these parents went to school with my parents. I went to school with their kids. They knew who my family was. They knew who I was. And so my family had the support that they needed back there. And again, obviously it would be harder, way harder on your mom than on your dad, but not that it's any lesser, but it's just the way the mama's boy, daddy's girl kind of thing goes.
But
I'm the oldest in my family, so I had a younger brother, younger sister, but they believed me. I didn't have to tell them again. I didn't have to repeat that. It was not a question of convincing them. Now it was a question of consoling them or allowing them to say, look, I'll be okay. Don't worry. I'll be all right. I didn't do this and it'll work out one day. And that took a whole lot of prayer.
Well, you're a tough guy. But as tough as the front that you had to put on for the people around you, what did it feel like to be not just in prison, but then to know that you're not getting out and to know it's death, like a death sentence?
Well, you do a lot of soul searching and introspect. Why me, Lord? What did I do to deserve this? My mom did send the Bible in. I was able to read it front to back three and a half times, actually, during those 10 years. Slept with it under my pillow. I found strength in the stories of Job and Jonah, you know, passages, out of the darkness shall come the light. Rejoice in trials and tribulation, where you shall find favor, sight of the Lord. There had to be a way to keep your head up. And again, as being a team player, as being a sports player, it's like my team believes in me. I can't give up for them. No, my mom, I'm okay. Now my friends will come visit from Phoenix and make a 2-hour drive down there to see me, and you know, have to go through visitation, the shakedowns, the searches, the clanging of the cell doors, the atmosphere, the smells to come and visit me. You know, while they're happy to see that, I think they were unhappy to see me afterwards. Was it worth the drive? Was it, you know, we can write. You don't have to come visit me. I mean, as nice as it was just things that I realized that I didn't do this. Lord knows I didn't do this. My family knows I did this. Somehow we're going to have to get the court system. No, they didn't do this. And after all the way it went at trial, my first trial was just 3.5 days. And 3 of those days was the prosecution of their lying. You know, a bite mark expert who said my teeth were unique and that bite marks are as individualized as fingerprints. And he's absolutely sure that that bite mark happened at the time of death. And that made me Ray Crone to murder. I mean, a very impressive, you know, he was the dean of the UNLV Dental School. He was a state senator from Las Vegas and elder in the Mormon Church. Curriculum vitae, you know, pages and pages long, very well-spoken, powerful, convincing speaker, you know, was sure that I was a killer. And I knew how wrong he was. I knew how the prosecutor treated me when I got on the stand and answered the questions from my attorney. And that prosecutor came up and started cross-examining me. So you deny killing Kim and Kona? I said, yes, I do. You denied being in the CBS lounge? I said, what night? The night you killed her, of course, Mr. Cronin. Just told him to me. I mean, after 2.5 hours of cross-examination, when I come down off that stand, I almost went over and sat down next to him. You know, it was that bad. So I just didn't still... wasn't convinced that the system that I believed in, the justice system that I was far away from until now, that I'm right in the middle of it, sitting in the middle of a circle, that it can't be this bad, that it can't be forever. And I got to hold myself together. And again, that bio was a big part of it, but the strength of my family and friends believing me made the difference. And I was going to hold on as long as it took. Unfortunately for me, it only took 3 years on death row.
That's nothing. What is prison like, Ray? Like what? You always hear three square meals in a cot. That's what you always hear. But what?
It's
what's
not
the
a country club. I'll give you a description of my cell. I mean, it was about 6x8. I could stand and touch both walls. All concrete. The typical, as you see on TV, stainless steel bathroom commode sink combination. Steel bars in the front with a sliding door. There had a trap about 4 or 5 inches tall and about 18 inches wide. That's where they fed you through. And I never got a hot meal on death row. You don't let people on death row work in the kitchen, not with all the potential weapons that are in there. Our food was prepared in another yard, put in carts, and wheeled over and sat in the hallways until they felt like feeding us. You could see the carts sitting out there. I had a cement slab for a bed, a cement slab for a table. I got one army blanket, one sheet, and one towel. I wrapped my towel around my sneakers. That was my pillow. I got 3 pairs of underwear, 3 pairs of socks, and 2 sets of jumpers. So we'd wash our clothes in the sink. I got out of that cell 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday was rec day. They'd come to your cell. You know, you'd have to strip down completely, everything off, then turn and twist and bend, make sure you weren't hiding anything anywhere in your naked body. They'd pat your clothes down, pass it in through that trap, that hole in the door. Again, you'd get dressed right in front of them, stick your arms out through. They put a pair of handcuffs on you that had a belt attached. You'd get handcuffed, then turn around, and that belt would be fastened at your waist so you couldn't move your hands any further than your pockets. They then would motion to a man outside the door, another guard that would open up the door for this officer, let you out there. You take 1 step out away from your door, turn and take 1 step away from the guard and freeze. And you better do it just like that, like military. If you don't, it's attempted escape or attempted assault. That guard will grab the belt and kick your legs out and floor plant you right there if you don't move exactly slow and easy away from him and freeze. At that point, they pat you down again to make sure you didn't hide anything in the last minute you got dressed in front of them. And then there was about an 18-inch long chain put around your ankles with 2 big locks on it. At that point, then they would motion to the other guard. He would come in and get with this guard and escort you out to a little chained-in area. It was a 10-foot square cement slab, had 10-foot hurricane fencing all around its sides and top. You were put in there. It had a basketball hoop, a basketball, a little makeshift bench weight machine like thing, a real cheap, cheesy, nothing came loose. It was mechanically, that was really jury rigged. Yeah. And you were in there for the next 2 hours. That was the only days you got a shower. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, went to rec. But I was outside. I mean, maybe I'd see an airplane fly over, maybe hear a car horn honk, a lawnmower, a dog bark, something remind me that world was going for
me. The world exists.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
The irony I feel like is that people who make a living doing bad things have to expect this kind of treatment. Like they've been in jail several times. They know what to expect. They know to follow the rules. But this whole time you're being thrown into this world where you didn't do anything wrong.
Oh my God.
It's a funny thing then too. At a certain point, there's no use going around saying I'm innocent. I mean, I didn't say I was guilty, but the inmates don't need to hear it. I'm not going anywhere. The guards don't care. No, nobody really cares. So it's like, I was again, fortunate. I was in county jail with a man was about a month ahead of me going through a trial for the murder of his wife, that they knew who killed her, but they said that he put her up to it. I talked with him. He was just a little bit older than me. But again, I believed he was innocent, just the way his feelings, the way he expressed how they treated him, what they said, things that I've felt and seen. And he got to death row just a month or two before me. After about a year there, he was working at the law library and ended up getting me a job at the law library. So now, because the rest of the time you spend in your cell, you never get out of your cell for anything but those 3 hours of rec. If you get a visit, you could get out and you could get a phone call twice a month for 15 minutes for $15. It cost your family back in 1992, 93.
Wow.
Sure. So I read a lot. We did get a TV if you could afford it. It's not cable TV, folks. Let me tell you about that. It's not cable TV. You can't have a TV with antennas on it. My God,
that's right. It's a weapon, neck. Yeah.
So our TVs did have a cable that plugged into the wall, but it went up to an antenna on the roof, and we got like four or five channels that they cabled into us. You know, it was Walt Disney and PBS and a news channel or something. But I, you know, so I read a lot of books. I worked out with weights. I'd fill up a trash bag with water until they ended up poking holes in the bags. I used my laundry bag with law books that I had. I was able to study my case and learn about the law that put me in there, the rules and regulations, things that were done right or wrong, and passed my time that way, writing letters and reading. And again, after a year or so down there, I was able to work at a law library, which at least got me out of my cell each day to go up to the law library and work with other inmates. Now, I still was separated, but I wasn't handcuffed anymore. I had a little bit of freedom to walk around in the law book library area, working with the books and helping other people. And I'll tell you an amazing story that, again, you don't talk much about your case, but I became a legal rep, helping represent guys that would get disciplinary action in there. I would be like their little lawyer before the disciplinary officer. And I got called out this one day to have a legal visit with this guy. And I was reading his letters for his mom, from his mom, all these different, you were only allowed to have these once a month. But anyway, I'd been reading the letters from his mom to him because he couldn't read or write. And then I was helping writing letters to his mom. I've been doing this for about 6-8 months. And finally, one day we got talking about his case. He was in there for signing a confession. A man that I know for a fact can't read or write because I'm writing letters to his mom.
Yeah.
So as personal as can be, signed a confession.
Could have said anything.
It did. Yeah. And again, that's because I'm such a special person, but we all find ways to survive or to make the best of something. Like some, I thought, well, you know, how bad is my situation? Here's another person here. I mean, and the more I worked with other people, there were people that didn't have family to support. There were people that didn't have anybody cared about them. There was ways to survive. There was ways to find a way to get up and get and do it again, same thing again tomorrow and the next day and the day after that.
Well, and you brought up an interesting point that led me into a question that I was going to ask you, and that's, When you're in this situation that seems endless, it seems hopeless, like you said, you even stopped preaching that your innocence. Behind the scenes, what are you doing in prison to try to, especially when you know you're innocent, to try to like build a case, build a defense? Do you study on your own, like you said you did? Are you talking to lawyers all day, every day, trying to like formulate a plan to get out of here?
Yeah, again, I was in Arizona. I can't speak for all the other places. Some might have been better, but some might have well been worse. I don't know. I don't know much about the justice system. And again, it took a year and a half. The biggest thing was just be able to get along, to be able to survive, to make sure that, you know, our prisons are racist. Mm-hmm. You're white, you stay with the whites. You're black, you stay with the blacks. Hispanic, you stay with the Hispanics. There's, you know, now on death row was a little less so because we were all facing the same ending. Mm-hmm. But you had to know the etiquette, the rules, the laws of prison. Incredibly, these people were in there for breaking society's laws, but they had their own set of prison rules, their own set of ethics, their own violations in there. And you would get stuck. You would get killed. I seen stabbing. I've been stabbed at times, not on death row, but my point was, first and foremost, you better learn about what the environment that you're living in, because you got to live there first before you can ever fight to get out. And if you can't get along in jail with the other people, if you can't get along in prison with people that are going to be there the rest of their lives, you're not going to have much of a life. So first it was learning how to survive the prison ethics, the prison rules, the prison laws. I never met the lawyer that represented me for my appeal. I talked to him on the phone, had letters from him. But
he was court appointed, right?
Yeah, all they do is take the court record, you know, the proceedings that were recorded by the stenographer and read through it and see what you're at. And if you have a lawyer that objects to things and questions things, then there is stuff to review. If your lawyer don't object to anything or doesn't, you know, make any requests or anything, there's nothing for this man to review and appeal. But let me just tell you how I met my very first attorney in jail, actually, before I even got convicted. That would just tell you that story quick. I'd probably been in the county jail there for about 2 months. I got called out to a legal visit, typical legal visit where you go out, you're in a glassed in room, you got a phone there. You know, I picked up the phone, a lady came in, set a briefcase down, introduced herself as representative from the public defender's office, said she was there to represent me on murder, kidnapping, and sexual assault. And then she said, "You can expect to be found guilty, but we're going to fight this on appeal." I went crazy. What do you mean I'm found guilty? I was on the bed. I started going off. She got the phone held away from her ear. God, I calmed down a little bit. She got the phone back up. She said, "Listen, Mr. Crone, I'm going to tell you something. I don't take that tone of voice from the judge. I don't take it from the prosecutor, and I'm certainly not going to take it from you." Hung up the phone, the briefcase, and left. I never seen her again.
That was the end of that.
I got a certified letter later on, within a week or so, from the public defender's office citing a conflict interest. They said they were being removed from my case. The next most likely suspect was the victim's ex-husband. They had a teenage daughter. It was her birthday party. He did something inappropriate with one of the little girls and was arrested for it. Rightfully so, I say. And they were representing him. And I was told in this letter that I was going to get a court-appointed attorney. I thought, great, right on. Now I'm going to get somebody who's going to do something for me. Right. Again, I had no experience with the justice system. I don't know how any of this stuff really works. I got called out one day to a judge's office. There was a man in there. They appointed this man to represent me, capital murder case. Man who'd never done a murder case before. He'd done some cases of sexual assault cases before, but he'd never done a murder case. He also, at that time, was granted $5,000 to defend me. $5,000 to represent me in a capital murder case in 1992. You can't even get a divorce for $5,000. No. So I got exactly what they wanted him to do. Nothing. That's why I was in trial. That's why I was sitting in the courtroom 7 months after my arrest. I'm facing the death penalty. But I have to say, God bless this worthless attorney. He never did an investigation, never got an expert, never given any money. But just before the trial was to start, I believe it was like a Thursday or Friday. The trial, I believe, was Monday or Tuesday. So we got called in the judge's chambers there in the courtroom there to prosecutor wanted to introduce a videotape made by their bite mark expert, a real impressive VCR tape, 40-some minutes long, of how he convincingly and conclusively matched my teeth to this bite mark. And my attorney was awake. He was paying attention. He objected. He said, "Your Honor, I've never seen this before. You can't allow this in at the last moment." Judge says, "Denied. You can review this over the weekend." And then in a burst of brilliance, probably never again recreated in my attorney's career, he said, "Your Honor, in light of that ruling, I'm going to need a 30-day continuance. I'm going to have time to study this." And the judge was consistent. He overruled and stuff. He was an ex-prosecutor. He was responsible for half a dozen people already on death row. He said, "Denied. We need to get this trial rolling." 7 months since the murder, and he's got to get a capital murder case rolling.
Yeah.
So the appellate attorney actually wrote this down. It was objection. The Arizona Supreme Court reviewed it, said that my attorney was well within his rights. The judge was wrong. That as a defendant, you have a right to know what evidence is going to be used against you. You have a right to receive that evidence in a timely manner. They said it shouldn't have been allowed in. They said my attorney should have been granted a 30-day continuance. Again, the judge was wrong. But just because there's an error, a mistake, an omission does not mean you automatically get a new trial. In Arizona, it's called harmless error evaluation. They then review it to determine whether or not this would have affected the verdict. Would it even matter to the jury? And their exact words were, "Without this videotape, there wasn't even a jury dismissal case against Mr. Crone." And they ordered a new trial. So that's how I got to my second trial.
I want to go back real quick. The gentleman you mentioned who helped you get the position in the law library, is he still in for the murder? And did you make friends when you were in there? Do you still talk to anyone?
I probably can say the man's name, Dan Willoughby. He has passed now. He was on death row. He did get another trial. He got his sentence reduced to life. It was unfortunate. This happened in Mexico. A lady killed his wife down there while he was out visiting with the children, doing vacationing stuff, came back, found his wife murdered. Later on, the prosecutors in Phoenix, Arizona said that he knew this person that did the killing, that he had planned this in Arizona. That gave them jurisdiction. They tried him on as setting up this murder. in Arizona to have his wife killed in Mexico and convicted him and sentenced him to death based on this other person's testimony that actually did the killing. Later on, the person recanted, said, you know, had lied before because they were promised something when they, you know, tied Dan in with the murder. The actual murderer recanted everything. Of course, prosecution always denies that. You can't trust them. They're a murderer. You can't believe what they say. When I got out, we both made a pact of each other. We both believed in each other's innocence. Again, from our experiences, personal experience, how much it sounded like echoed what the other person's feelings were. Mm-hmm. When I got out, I told my attorney to investigate. There's nothing they could do. There's no evidence that proves he didn't kill her because he didn't kill her. There's no evidence right. He can prove that he didn't set this up because the prosecution used this person who lied in the testimony saying he did do it and then later recanted. They're not going to accept the recantation. But he was a person I would consider a friend if you have a friend. You don't make friends in prison. You make acquaintances. You make friends in prison if you're a criminal. You know, if you got a criminal enterprise or there's something, I don't know anything from a gang to whatever it might be, you might make friends in there. You know, you might have blood brothers, everything else. But no, I had acquaintances in there. I wouldn't want them dating my sister living next to my mom. That's just true. Most people in there deserve to be in there. That's a fact. And some of them actually want to be in there. That's where they're comfortable at. And that's a fact. I wasn't, Dan Willoughby wasn't that type. Dan Willoughby had no record. I had no record. I'm a veteran, you know, those type of things. I was not the common denominator in prison, especially on death row. Right. But there were people that I could get along with. There's people you have to get along with. Again, as I said, prisons are run by gangs, whatever color you are. There's a shot caller in each little section, whether it's in your pod, whether it's in your unit, whether it's in that whole yard. There's a shot caller for your group, for your race.
Wow.
That military upbringing had to help you a little bit in some weird way.
Yeah, wrestling in high school helped me a lot, too.
That, too.
Is there anything now that, like, will trigger, like, a smell, a sound? Is there anything that will put you back there?
It's past now. Again, it's been 20-some years. I can tell you, when I first got out, there was a lot of things. You better not come up behind me. Sure. Because that's how you stab people. There was things I wasn't getting in elevators with other people with little kids. There were certain things, and that's not exactly a trigger. I didn't go into buildings and sit with my back to the door. If I went to a restaurant, a bar, or something, here's an example. Now, when I got out, the day I was released was not free to go. I had to wait 3 weeks to go before a judge, but I was out on OR. I had to stay in a hotel. I'm walking down the sidewalk one day, and all of a sudden I'm noticing I'm bumping into car mirrors and parking meters and telephone poles here in Phoenix, Arizona. And I'm like, dick. I was walking past the construction zone. There was a chain link fence on the other side of the sidewalk over there. In prison, you got to stay 5 feet away from the fences. You can't get that close. There's like a little warning track, like a baseball field. Here I was, you know, only a week out, you know, and I'm, you know, over here staying away from that chain link fence. The P word, you can call people just about any name you want in prison. You don't call them a punk. I don't care how loud it is. You could be a rock concert. If somebody called or somebody a punk, it would got quiet. That just don't go down there in our prison. Wow. So you better not use that word around me. You know, there was things. And again, I had to get in fights. I'm not a bully. I defend myself because they're always going to look for the weak. I'm 6 foot tall. I was 190 pounds. By the time I got out of death row, I was doing 100 push-ups and doing 20 pull-ups. So I was pretty stout. I wasn't the weakest, easiest person to pick on, even though I wasn't the youngest person at 35, 38 years old when I got off of death row. But I was not a little person. But you still got to be tested whenever you go to somewhere new. They want to know what you're in there for. Thank you, Lord. I was not convicted of sexual assault. That would have been ugly.
Yeah.
Nobody likes a rapist. Everybody got a mom or a sister.
That's what I hear.
And worse yet, child molesters. But there were things that for a while, years, that did bother me. Again, I won't call it post-traumatic stress. I know people that were actual warriors, true Vietnam warriors, people that know noises, bangs, and things like that triggers them for a fact. I've seen it happen to them. I wasn't that type of jumpy, but there were things that I would, could, or wouldn't do. But that P word was one thing. You better not use that word around me. I say the P word, but that was one thing that was a trigger that would cause a lot of problems. If somebody, you know, because I could just say one time I was in a bar and somebody said, "You're in prison. Oh, you weren't a punk, were you?" And that was almost a lockup night there. Luckily it was taken care of, but, But that is one thing I know. I'm good now. You can hear I'm using a word. I wouldn't even brought that up. I had some friends that have talked to me about it over have seen me, have been there when this stuff kind of stuff has happened. And again, I don't want to go back to prison. There's no reason I should go back to prison. But that's something that could cause a lot of trouble with me. And again, a lot of people, if you're ever around bikers, there's a lot of bike clubs in there. You don't ever touch their colors. You don't ever touch their patches. You don't ever touch their cuts. You don't touch their. Or there's trouble. And so there are some things you have to relearn. When I was out there, or I had to learn first when I was in there, had to unlearn when I was out.
Right. There. Unlearn them.
So I imagine there's a lot of dark moments, especially on death row. What is it that ultimately kept you going, especially during like the darkest times?
Yeah, especially Ray, when you I've never met someone who had a literal death clock. You were on death row, you knew it was going to end in death if nothing changed. So that's got to change your outlook.
There's a lot of things to answer to that. First of all, I never believed they were going to execute me. I never had nightmares. I never believed that would happen. They executed 6 people in those 3 years I was there. So I know what those people went through. Some of them never mentioned, never said anything about it. There weren't nobody kicking and screaming, oh, no, don't kill me. I want to live. It's kill me. Do me a favor. Mm-hmm. People suffering all the time. It's living and suffering is what hurts you, not the dying part. You know, people die fast. It's quick. It's done with whatever. You know, if you kill me, do me a favor. That's how much they were suffering. That's how much they hated living in that environment. And that's a funny thing. People think that, oh, we'll give them the death penalty. They'll deserve that. That's the ultimate punishment. I hate the ultimate punishment. Make them live the rest of their life in there under them circumstances, every day suffering. Maybe, just maybe, there's something good can come of it. They might be able to do something good. Maybe if it's just as simple enough to tell where the body is. Maybe it's simple enough. I know one man in there that was actually writing greeting cards, writing letters to some, you know, ended up talking with their victims' families. But killing somebody, that ends the suffering. That ends the punishment right there.
Yeah.
You know?
Interesting.
And I've learned that firsthand. But the isolation was the worst part of death row. I was not in the yard walking free, walking out around people. That came later on, and that was worse because now's when the fights, now's when the trouble, now's when the racism came on. Now's when you better be looking, having set eyes out the back of your head kind of
thing. Survival mode.
Yeah. On death row, you were locked in. You were locked down all the time. So, you know, the biggest thing, again, was the support of my family, knowing that they believed in me, that I didn't have to convince them, and finding strength in the Bible. Each night I'd read something and put it under my pillow, and knowing and believing it still. The Lord knows I'm innocent. By God, I surely want to believe in the Lord and have faith in the Lord that there's a reason, a purpose for this. And there's times that it was tough. There was time different things would happen that you'd see somebody lose their appeals. You'd see something, and we all lived vicariously through other people. People were cheering when I walked off death row. People were happy for me because maybe it could be them one day. Somebody is getting out. It didn't matter who it was. There weren't no selfish jealousy, you know. It was like, hey, something could happen. We cheered when somebody got there. We rooted somebody to get a new trial, you know. That's the way it was. And again, thankfully, the racism wasn't so bad in there because we were all facing that same proverbial sword.
Sure.
You know, toward the back of our neck. But those dark days were, again, you have to have support. You have to have something to believe in. And I was fortunate, again, because I had that. But I could see other people around me then. And it just made me say, be thankful. Praise the Lord.
Wow.
Well, when Arizona finally passes this law allowing post-conviction DNA testing, like, you learned about this, obviously. Did you feel, was that hopeful? Was this like, this is the moment. This is going to be my ticket out of here.
It was. And now by then, I'd already done about 8 years. By then, I'd already had a second trial. I already got sentenced to life. Now the judge said he had lingering residual doubt of my guilt and sentenced me to life instead of sending me back to death row. Now I walk to
ER. Which, by the way, is crazy to hear a judge reflect like that.
That was his exact words. He said that was a mitigating factor, that outweighed the aggravating factor and sentenced me to life. He said the case would haunt him for the rest of his life. But again, I had a cousin. It actually was my mom's cousin. I guess that makes it second cousin or something. I don't know how that removed stuff is. But his mom was my grandma's sister, and they lived in California. She met a serviceman, and way back in the 50s or something, moved to California. The only relatives that does not live in York County, Pennsylvania, raised 3 boys. And one day they were watching a crime show of some type, and his mom said something to him about having a relative on death row in Arizona, and he was stunned. His name's Jim Ricks. God bless you, Jim. Jim is in heaven now. In the past year, but he was stunned. He was like, what do you mean? Somebody in our family, a relative of ours, is on death row? What kind of monster? He lived in Lake Tahoe. He had his own business where he did computer stuff, writing programming and stuff like that. It was really successful. And he came to visit me on death row, first time I ever met him. And we talked, and by the end of it, he believed in me. He said, something went right here. He spent the rest of that time that I was in prison fighting to get me free. Wow. And he's the one who was writing letters to people. He was the one who was got my second trial attorney. He's the one that went to see a bite mark experts for my second trial. We had three bite mark experts at my second trial testify that it wasn't me.
Mm-hmm. It was an all-star team. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. He was the one on the outside representative for me that talked to the lawyers. A very intelligent man, very, very motivated, very driven. And he's the one that talked to some lawyers that when they passed that new law, post-conviction relief, DNA testing, only on previously untested DNA material that was properly maintained, preserved, and would have direct bearing on guilt or innocence. Now, Kim had been initially stabbed with a butcher knife from the kitchen so forcefully through her back that it actually bent the blade, a big butcher knife being bent. And so most of the experts, most of the people that investigators and stuff that we had talked to all said, well, the perpetrator probably got hurt. I mean, if you take stabbing into a table that hard that it bends, your hand's most likely going to go into that little edge of that blade there. Mm-hmm. And so when they passed that new law, thankfully, the Phoenix Police Department had kept the clothing. This person that stabbed, well, his name is Kenneth Phillips. Kenneth Phillips had actually stabbed her so hard through the clothing, it bent the knife, and then he cut her clothes off of her. Different parts, cut the sleeves. Mm-hmm. The clothing was all there in the bathroom. They had kept that, preserved that. So when my attorney went to look at this clothing, again, under the assumption that maybe there should be some blood left from the perpetrator, there was a stain on her underwear. There was stain inside of her blue jeans, appeared to be blood. Now, this was 8 years old, 9 years old, almost 10 years old by then. But under that new law, he petitioned the courts to have DNA testing done on that under assumption that this was blood from the perpetrator because of where it was. And of course, there was a hearing. It goes before a judge. The prosecutor, same prosecutor put me on death row, was there, told the judge, it's a wild goose chase, it's a fishing expedition. It's a waste of the court's time and money, Your Honor. Don't grant this motion. Nevertheless, the judge ordered that DNA test done. Thank you, Judge.
Yeah.
And they ordered the Phoenix Police Department's recently accredited DNA lab to do that testing. Now, the last people in the world I wanted touching any of this DNA was the Phoenix Police Department.
Right.
He was fired, and that courtroom was Phoenix Police Department. And I'll give you the perfect example. That detective that I told you that came up to me in my driveway very initially there, when he was questioned on the stand by the prosecutor said, now, when you informed Ray Crone of Kim's death, did he say or do anything that alarmed you in all your years as a homicide detective? He said, yes, right away, Crone denied associating with her. I never denied associating with her. I said I wasn't a boy. How does that sound, though?
Yeah, right.
That's what he said in the court of law, in front of a jury, in front of the audience. That's what he said. Crone denied associating with her.
It's like, no, I didn't.
Anyway, that's why I didn't trust the police. But it turned out to be a blessing. Because by then, only law enforcement agencies had access to the DNA data bank. The CODIS was being stored, and that accesses all of it around the country. And so when they extracted DNA from the pants, the underwear, it was somebody else. It wasn't me. It wasn't the victim. And I say, you go, girl. Because this lab technician took that DNA, put it in the national data bank, and it spawned the world or whatever the heck it does, and came back with a match to a man that was currently serving a 10-year sentence for having sexually assaulted a child.
So one of the things that stood out to me, first of all, I want you to react to that, because that moment, indescribable. I mean, can you even put into words that moment? But also, it was a Native American hair the whole time that they had. And I'm not sure why, like, didn't that come into play? You're clearly not Native American or Asian, how they described it.
Very good point. Again, my second trial, which in comparison, lasted 7 weeks. Three bite mark experts testified for the defense. DNA was identified on a saliva that was not my DNA. Hair that was not even my ethnicity. Footprint size 9.5. I wear a size 11. My bare foot.
That too.
Old footprint. In the bathroom and in the kitchen where the knife was taken, in the bathroom where the body was found. But now the DNA part of it. And again, I'm in prison. You don't talk over the phone with your family or anything. Your attorneys can come in. That's privacy. But anything else is listened to. So I'm finding this out piecemeal, slowly, with somebody come to visit. Excuse me. Somebody would come visit me, could tell me what was going on. But most of it was just the family say, well, something's happening here. We'll let you know when we know more. But I was excited to know that there was going to be DNA testing done. But really, until the very last moment that I was told that they actually got a match. And again, this is a typical system. This is how bad the prosecution, this is how bad Maricopa County justice system is. This started in October when they ordered DNA testing done. We were told it would take 6 to 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. January comes, we still ain't had a word back. February. Wow. We're wondering what's going on here. My understanding is it was actually leaked by one of the lab technicians to my attorney, Chris Plourde. He was a very famous attorney out of California. Very well liked man, an expert, a wonderful, wonderful guy. He's a judge.
Good
now
man.
Out
great
there.
Man.
It was leaked to him that the testing had already been done, and they're on their fourth test now, having to retry it again because the prosecutor requested it. Four times they'd rather redid the DNA, that they already had a match to somebody, and they were still trying to tie me to it. Finally, in April, was finally, I'm in a yard now in Yuma, Arizona. I got just right around lunchtime, noontime, I get called out to a counselor over there. I'm going to miss chow. You don't want to miss chow. We only got like 1,800 calories a day in prison, you know. And so I'm going over to talk to the counselor there from the yard. And he says, oh, yeah, your attorney's on the phone. It was Alan Simpson from Phoenix. He said, Ray, how you doing today? I said, fine, just another day in paradise. He laughed. He said, no, really. He said, what do you want to eat? I said, what are you talking about? I'll eat whatever's in the chow hall. He said, no, really, what do you want? Steak, seafood, Mexican food, what would you like? I said, Alan, what the devil are you talking about? He said, I just got off the phone with the prosecutor's office. They just got back from the judge's chamber.
Oh, my gosh.
April, you're coming home today. I said, what did you just say? He said, roll up, Ray, you're coming home. I mean, I was dumbfounded. I mean, how? And I'm looking at the counselor there, and they got the phone back to him. He hangs up. He said, I don't know anything about that. You know, he said, you know how lawyers are. And about that time, his phone rings again. He picked it up. Yes, sir. He's sitting right here. Yes, sir. His eyes get big. He said, yes, sir, absolutely. Yes, sir, I'll take care of it. Hung up. He said, that was the warden. He said, you need to go back and get your stuff. You're going to be released.
Wow.
I was stunned.
Unbelievable.
About 2.5 hours later, I walked out of that prison, start my life all over again. Chris Plourde was over in California. Now, Yuma's right there on the border. He was over in El Centro, California. He came over, picked me up. I'm walking out the yard. People are in the rec pen there yelling and cheering, go home, Ray. I was on the television. When I got back to my cell, it was already on the 12 o'clock news. People were inside jumping up and down. I looked through the window. I thought it was a fight going on. I have to run in there and find out they're all celebrating for me to go home.
It was
home.
A parade.
The man that came in civilian clothes, the officer that came to walk me out was actually a CO, original correction officer out of Death Row that remembers from then, walking me out. He says, I remember you from Death Row. People said there was something different about you. Said you might not have been guilty. All this stuff happened so fast that one day, just like that one day, I woke up in my bed and got questioned by the police and ended up being in jail that night. This day morning, I woke up in prison and walked out that day to start my life all over again at the age of 45.
And what is that like, having to rebuild everything?
Yeah, because you lost everything.
It takes, well, I did, you know, but I didn't lose my life, thank God, and that's what they wanted to take. I didn't lose my self-esteem, my respect for myself, my family and friends and people that knew me gained because they were right all along, that they stood up in the face of anybody that agreed with the prosecutor, the police, that my family was right. And I was able to talk and speak about it, which happened right away as soon as I got out, because I walked out the gate with my attorney where I drove out the gate, and there was lights, cameras, news set up. Because at the time that I was released, I was not only, you know, start my life over again at the age of 45, I was 100th person in America to have faced the death sentence and later be free. 100 mistakes have now been made. Documented 100 people that were sentenced to death, were proven innocent, were later freed. And so the media was there, asked me, what was it like? What am I going to do? And I talked about the support of my family, how I survived, the Bible underneath my pillow. And one of the reporters standing there, I mean, there was a dozen of them, lights, camera, everything all around there. One of the reporters raised his hand. He said, well, Mr. Crone, and this is how he talked, Mr. Crone, given your faith in God, how do you justify him leaving you in prison for 10 years? What? How do I justify God leaving me in prison for 10 years? How do you answer a deep soul-searching question like that? I mean, I'm stunned. I'm frozen there, and they're all leaning forward with the cameras and the microphones and all the lights. And it's something shot in my head. I said, well, you know, maybe it's not about those 10 years I spent in prison. Maybe it's about what I have to do the next 10 years.
Attaboy.
Wow.
I thought about it later on, and that's what it was. I mean, again, while those 3 weeks I was staying there, I was interviewed on television. I was asked to go speak at, I believe it was a Rotary Club, Ramsey International, something was meeting there in Phoenix that time. I went and spoke with them. It was part of my readjustment then now to get back. I didn't know anything about life. I got into cars. The next thing I'm trying to turn the turn signals on. I got windshield wipers flashing and I mean, I didn't.
They don't have keys anymore. They have buttons to turn them on.
Yeah. As soon as I got to that, this happened. As soon as I got done with that interview that day, the Chris said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, I got a $50 gate check here. The money that they kept, they gave you this out of your pay over the years. And I said, I'm going to cash this and get some real food. He goes, I'll give you $100 for that right now. I said, no, it's only $50. He said, I'll give you $100 for it. Anyway, he ended up getting a check from me. He had a plaque, put a plaque on it and mounted it and had it on his wall in his law office is what he
That's
done.
That's hilarious.
That wow.
But we went to a little convenience store. I was in Yuma, Arizona. Phoenix was about three and a half, four hours away. I was making my way back to Phoenix. We stopped at a convenience store, and I'm going in there. I'm just going to get me a regular old bean and beef burrito and iced tea.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's about 8 or 10 different types of burritos now. There's at least 5 or 6 different types of iced teas I got to pick my way through, besides different brands of iced teas. Finally, I got what I wanted. I went over to the microwave, and I'm looking at this thing. I don't even know what to do with this thing here now. There's a little kid right there picking out some. And I said, you know how to work this? He goes, yes, sir. And he got it, did something quick and put it in there and looked at me and walked away. And it flashed and beeped, and I got it out of there. I don't even know how it worked, but I had to laugh at myself. But that was part of my adjustment, was laughing at things. I wasn't stupid. I was ignorant. I didn't know things, but I wasn't stupid. I could learn.
Those were the problems that you can deal with.
Yeah, everything was new to me. I didn't even know what was a good price for things. But my family, friends, everybody there was just so caring and concerned to help me out. They wanted to be part of how can we help you. When I got back to Pennsylvania, people were doing so much things for me, donated stuff. My folks had acquired my great-grandpa's property that I grew up in, actually one of the houses on the property, was now converted into a semi-apartment, two apartments. So I had a place to live. One of my friends was a plumber. He put me to work helping him. You know, just everybody was there to help me. And it was almost humbling because I was the oldest one in the family. I was, you know, I was the older brother. I was the one that was supposed to help other people, you know, and it was humbling to have people do that for me. But it was easy for me because of that support that I had. And again, it reminded me of all those people I knew, the people I believed that may be innocent, that did not have that help, did not have people in prison that didn't. And there were people in there for killing their loved one.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Right.
How do you survive that? You're convicted of killing your wife. Your family's against you. Your in-laws are all against you. Your kids are now against you. They're turned against you. I mean, so there's so many things for me to be thankful for. Not only was I released, but they got who did it. There's no question of my innocence. Yeah. I don't think I'd have walked around too well if there were people say, oh, he did it, got away with it. Because that's what the cops do. That's what the prosecutors do when they don't grab you. So all those things worked in my favor. And then to be able to go out and talk about it, to share it with people. See people line it up afterwards to come stop by and shake my hands. The newspapers want to know how it feels. What am I going to do? I talked to most of the high schools in York County when I got out, voluntarily go to their assemblies. I'll tell you this story because it's one of the emotional things, and I'll probably tear up a little bit. But I was speaking to the law school in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Penn State took it over now. I was speaking at this law school. And at the end, usually people come up to the stage up front where I'm at and usually want to shake my hand, say something, sign something, whatever it is, get a picture taken. And I noticed this one young man and the ladies that kept holding back, letting everybody go. And when everybody was going past, he came up, he said, Mr. Crone, he said, you may not remember me. He said, you spoke at my high school a couple of years ago. He said, and I wanted you to introduce you to my mom. You're the reason I'm going to law school.
Wow. And
I don't know that it didn't make those 10 years worth it, so to speak, but it made those 10 years meaningful. It gave it a reason. And there's just a number of things, opportunities. I've been to Europe to speak and travel. I have so many opportunities to do things that is part of still my adjustment to it. Again, if the Lord chose me, then so be it. I do what I want. But most of all, I want my family, my friends that believed in me from the beginning to be very proud and to know that I'm okay. They worried about me while in prison. I don't want them worrying about the rest of my life.
You're a strong man. And I think that the things that you endured, you could very easily choose to be bitter at the world. You can obviously be bitter at the justice system, which no one would blame you for that, but also the world just for the way this, you know, everything was handled. And I think that the fact that you're choosing forgiveness, and speaking of forgiveness, I don't want to forget to ask you about Kim Ancona's family reaching out to you and like apologizing.
The day I finally went before a judge, like I say, it was 3 weeks after my release. The family was opening to go before the judge. They had this schedule for this post-conviction relief hearing, actually, which point that the judge looked at the evidence and ordered a new trial. I was not free to go. He ordered a new trial. At that point, the prosecutor stepped forward, not the prosecutor put me on death row, but the head prosecution, the head DA of Maricopa County there, stepped forward and said, we're dropping charges with prejudice. Meaning they can never retry me again.
Right.
And at which point the judge banged the gavel, Mr. Crone, you're free to go. And of course, my local friends, my family were there. People were cheering and hollering. And I noticed Kim's mom was there. And she was always a frail, older lady, a smaller stature. By this time, she was walking with a cane. She came up to the crowd. I'm cleared away. She came up to me. She said, "Mr. Crone, I just want to apologize to you. I'm so sorry for what happened to you. I know what it's like to lose a loved one. I mean, your mom lost you for 10 years. I lost my daughter." She said, "I'm so sorry. I just believed what they told me." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Man,
what else can she do?
Because both of my trials, of course, you have victim impact statements. I mean, she spoke vehemently and angrily about me. I'm hatefully and rightfully so. I said, "Ma'am, I understand. There's no need to apologize. I completely understand. You were lashing out at the person that killed your daughter. It wasn't me. I never took it personally, and I understood. Believe me. And it's my first opportunity to offer my condolences. I knew your daughter for just a short time, but she did seem to be a wonderful person." I said, "So your apology is certainly accepted. And again, it's not necessary." And we hugged.
Aww.
Just a few years ago now, I was actually doing a TV show. I can't even remember if it was Arrest and Trial. Death Row Stories or
mm-hmm.
I've done a lot of, but anyway, her son was introduced to me on this show here. And he was in his teens, maybe 15, 16, somewhere near. There was two trials. They were like 3 years apart. By a second trial, my family had actually said that he had actually made mention to them at the breaks in between time when people would go outside and actually made a comment or something about he wasn't sure of my guilt because all the new evidence was coming out. Stuff that did not, DNA wasn't mine. Hair, it wasn't mine. You know, I'm home in bed, footprints that weren't mine. Anyway, he was introduced to me then, and he had been suffering all those years with, at least in his own words, I won't say it exactly the way he said it, but basically he was traumatized from this because he felt some type of guilt, some type of pain, some type of internal imbalance because of the way he felt and what happened to me and how it went. And he just, he emotionally was touched by it in a negative way, if we will. Again, I'm sorry, my words don't really explain it because I'm talking about somebody else, but it was a moving moment right there where we hugged in mm-hmm. tears and in his eyes and all this because he had every reason to hate me all along. I mean, anybody that was a friend of hers, a family member of hers would want to hate the person that killed him. I mean, it's only rightfully so, but he had his druthers. He had his doubts about whether or not he should or shouldn't. And that caused a turmoil, a real upheaval in his life for all those years. And there was an opportunity on this show years and years after my release, unfortunately for him, the way it seemed, because it really did seem like it was releasing a burden. I mean, we even after the show was done filming, I mean, we still talked for quite a while there. It was, I mean, you might spend 5 hours filming the show and it might only be 45 minutes when it's done.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But I did get to talk with his mom and I did get to talk with her son at some point along the lines in both their lives. And
was that therapeutic for you?
Yes, and absolutely. And again, I don't think any of us, well, I don't think anybody I know, the friends I know, people I consider friends and family would want to be hated by someone, would want to make it right. If there was something that I did personally, then you might have deserved it, you know. But not unintentionally have somebody hating you for something that right. was wrong, that you didn't do. I think most right. of all of us would want to correct that at whatever opportunity we have to do it. And so that's what it was for me. And again, it was very moving. It's one of those that evening, it was something that, you know, you thought about, thought about, thought about, and just say, wow, how fortunate or how monumental that was.
Very cool.
Yep.
Well, if there's someone listening right now who is wrongfully convicted or someone listening who loves someone who has been wrongfully convicted, what would you want them to hear from you?
It's always a fight. It's supposed to be a fight, and it's always uphill once that conviction is in there. Work hard before that happens, but once you're at that point there, you can't give up, and the support that you offer to your loved one as a tremendous building block in their ability to withstand and endure the system that has now had its full weight upon them. It'll give them the strength to endure those days, the faith to believe that people believe in me, the system can find the truth in me one day. It's never going to be easy. If it was easy, this stuff would never happen before because it shouldn't happen to begin with. But I can only say this. I felt, for lack of a better word, the love. And love can come in all different forms for different reasons. But this was an actual pure love of somebody caring so much about your well-being that they would make sacrifices to do what they can. Is it a mother's love for their children? I mean, a father's love for their child. I mean, that type of love that people care. People that don't have to, people can say, oh, well, they deserve it. Or, oh, well, I mean, they're on their own now. Find that strength if you're on the outside, that belief. If you believed in it to begin with, you stay that course, because there's going to be a whole lot of outside interference and noise that's going to try to make you stop, going to try to make you quit. And if you're the one on the inside, find that strength to know that even if it's just one person that cares, don't let that person down. You keep that strength to maintain. Allow them to allow themselves to help you. It's a team effort, and it takes a team. And I wish I could lay healing hands in one plain word to say faith, strength. It takes a group of things together. But one thing is, you don't quit. You know in your heart what you are. And there's other people that have the same kind of heart. Those people will find you. They will find you, and you'll be stronger because of it.
Ray, this was you're a beautiful man for the way you look at life. And I can't thank you enough for coming on today. Your case has lived with me my whole career. And there's, in this true crime space, there's a community that is always asked, what got you into true crime? What jump-started your love of true crime? So people like love these stories, but I kind of fell into it. So it was a direction that I wanted to take with my life, get into television, and it just happened to be true crime. And with Kim's case, with your case, that's the answer I always give to people, because I've covered, I think now I've reached 200 and I'm a little over 200 cases, people, stories that I've covered, that I've had the chance to cover either on the podcast or with shows. And yours will always stick with me because it was my very first. And just learning about the justice system and the injustices in the system, and just how somebody can come out the other side. I feel like this taught you so many lessons and turned you into the man that you are today. So for all the awful things that happened, you're amazing. And I can't thank you enough for being here.
You are. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, my thanks to you for sharing that, because again, that goes to what I said. There must've been a reason I was put in that position. It must've been a reason my family, people were involved in this, to get to a point where it can help other people now.
Perfect. Well, that is our goal as well.
We make a difference.
Awesome, Ray. We really, really appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was incredible. You're incredible.
Yeah, you're kind.
All right, we'll talk soon, Ray.
Okay, Ray's case terrifies me because you know I have such a jack-o'-lantern smile and it's such a distinctive bite. Like, when he was saying about he would bite into a sandwich or he would bite his arm, I'm like, I would totally do that because I know my bite.
I know, right? And it's just such a powerful conversation. I mean, I think it's an incredible testament to his will and the fact that he used God to help drive him and found something that can propel him toward the outcome that he knew was the truth. Just so cool.
His outlook on everything reminds me so much of Jody Laird.
Yes.
Who was one of our guests back in, I don't know, July of 2024. I think it was like our second block. And
it was early.
Jody had, just like Ray, has every right to hate the world and be bitter. And she's not, and he's not. And I don't know how they do that. I don't know how they do that.
I don't either. I have a minor inconvenience and it upsets me, like ruins my day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, this is cool. And what do I want to say? Hold on. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed that perspective. If you have any questions for Ray, let us know. We can absolutely send him a message, get you answers. Or if you just have comments about the episode or about Ray's ordeal, which ordeal doesn't seem to do it justice, but
yeah, what do you,
for lack
call
of a better
that?
Word, I don't know.
It's a missing chapter of your life. I mean, I understand that it was part of your life, so it's part of the whole thing, but it's just like missing time. It's wild. Yeah.
100%. Well, what do we got coming up next month?
We are going to be, I don't think we have a block name yet because we're not that on top of things, but
we have all the cases.
We have the cases. We just don't have a name. Yeah. We're going to be talking about short sentences. Like,
because it's a short, because February is a short month.
Exactly.
See what we did there?
See that? Look, okay. Maybe we are on the ball, but not
pretty
really.
pretty damn good.
We're kind of like cats, where like we can kind of take care of ourselves for a couple days, but there should probably be someone checking in every now and then.
Leave the toilet lid open.
Yeah, like you're probably good for like 3 days, but like, good thing we have Brenda and Scott to check in.
Yeah, Melissa needs snacks every 3 hours.
True.
Yeah, short sentences. So basically, we're going to cover crimes where either the person got off way too easy for what they did and then went on to cause more problems. And we're only going to tease it a little bit, but the guest that we have tentatively lined up will be super cool. He's pretty high profile.
Yeah.
Too, and he's got a, it's a movement that he's been a big part of.
He's actually someone I've mentioned in one of my cases, a recent case. So
it's true. And I believe I even dropped his name a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. You always yell at me and say, you can't say it. You can't tell anyone yet. You can't say it. And look at you. Just run.
But it was
mouth.
The fact, you know why? It was because you brought him up without my knowledge. And I'm like, oh, he's going to be our guest. Like it just.
Well, then you edited it. So you could have cut that out too.
Oh, shit. I did. It's true. Good, fair point. This one's on me.
Oh, boy. On that note, we have a Patreon, guys. Not sure if you know about it. Pretty new, but it's pretty awesome. There are a couple episodes out already. There's two episodes, a full length and a mini. And then what we're doing is we are going to try to early release episodes as much as we can. For example, this last week, which aired on Tuesday, we released it Sunday night to Patreons ad free. So if that's something you're interested in, you can go to patreon.com/murderunscripted or just go to Patreon and search for us and it will explain all the tiers, but we would love to have you.
That is true. And we had a couple of people sign up and we are going to thank them. Now's not the place. We'll thank you guys next week, but we're very excited about that you're along for the ride.
And again, if you have any questions for Ray, hit us up. Let us know. You can get us on our socials at Murder Unscripted. You can email us murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. Or you can drop us a line through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
It's the places.
Yes, it is.
It sure is.
Well, until next week, we hope that you stay safe. We hope that you stay hydrated. And we hope that you remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts. They do, however, have mustaches and half beards growing back. It's much better this week.
Didn't I tell you 3 days it would be back? I was pushing hard.
Okay. All right.
Getting that beard out.
Like Play-Doh. Bye.